Good evening, all.
Evening.
It's a Wednesday night, and we find ourselves here again. This is the beginning of our study of the book Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. I can actually use the word trepidation, Ivan.
With trepidation?
I am beginning this course, and every time, I don't know how many of these books I've been through in the last four or five years, but every time I start it, I hope beyond hope that it'll just last maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Good
and
that
we'll be able to get to maybe 2, 3, 4 chapters a night. And I understand so clearly the whole concept of you can't get the child into the bathtub, but once they're in there, you can't get them out. And that's what I suffer from as well, is the foreboding in a sense. In a foreboding in a sense before we get started. So welcome everybody. These shows will last roughly 1 hour, though we're not totally constrained to the exact hour anymore, and we'll go, you know, maybe if we need to go over a little bit, it'll be fine, but more, a bigger meal than that's a little, it's a pretty full meal at that time. And so what these interactions flourish when there are questions. If it's just Ivan and I talking, it's interesting, certainly interesting to me, but they flourish when interaction begins. These are challenging chapters. They are challenging because not because they're intellectually challenging, but because they'll challenge where you are and the owning of your own place within the very beginnings of the work and your position on the path. It'll be challenging from that point of view. So we are not beginners anymore. But as usual, I want to take a moment and make sure that as we begin the class, Ivan and Molly, that we kind of clear ourselves off of road dust. We actually work to enter the space. So I'm going to read something. I threatened to read it at the end of the last course that we were doing, but I couldn't find it.
Okay. So this would be an appropriate time.
It's an appropriate time, and it's a quote from one of the works of Spinoza. We've worked with him before. This happens to be the very first paragraph of On the Improvement of the Understanding, which was his first draft of his seminal work called The Ethics. And that has a place in the history of Western thought. So, kind of loosen your ties a little bit. Rest a second, unless you're driving. Place your feet on the floor and just for a moment, come into the space and listen for this, and then we'll walk, we'll open the book up and see where we go, okay? Okay, here we go. After experience had taught me that all the usual surroundings of social life are vain and futile, and seeing that none of the objects of my fears contained in themselves anything, either good or bad, except insofar as the mind is affected by them, I finally resolved to inquire whether there might be some real good having power to communicate itself to me, which would affect the mind solely to the exclusion of all else, whether, in fact, there might be anything of which the discovery and attainment would enable me to enjoy continuous, supreme, and unending happiness. So, that's the challenge laid before us by Mr. Benedictus Spinoza 450 years ago. Well, except he says it isn't. And that's the whole point. It isn't. Because what he says in here, he says, of which the discovery and attainment, he puts on himself the burden of working to get this. His inquiry here is just, does such a thing exist? Does such a thing exist? Could it exist? I'm willing to find out and spend my life devoting myself to see, does such a thing exist? He found the answer. He found the answer. It took years and much difficulty for this individual. We're in the same boat. We are exactly in the same boat, and that's the point that we are making and we are going to make in this course. So, where are we? We're discussing, and our leverage point is a book called The Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. This happens to be the new edition.
You may have
and some people might have the older edition. I'll be reading from this one. My older edition fell apart. I'm not sure why.
I happen to have one that's nearly mint.
Nearly mint, he says. So, as we've done in the past, but I feel so different and so new at this moment. I feel like we're doing this for the first time, and I'm meeting everybody that's here for the first time. And you've come invited to the meal. So let's work and enhance this banquet together. So we're going to... Ivan pounded on me pretty heavy earlier about wanting to study and read the introduction. I think I won out. We're not going to study the introduction, but I strongly urge you to read the introduction. It's important, and it'll give you a basis for how to look at it, how to look at what we're doing. And I'll explain that a little bit more as we go forward. So, Ivan, do you want to get us started? Why don't you read the header,
the header,
and then we'll go from there. Thank you.
Chapter 1, Lost in Amazement. Unknowingly, we voyage in a labyrinth, a macro-dimensional maze of living electrical force, cloaked by a thick layer of ordinary light. Our most serious obstacle is the uncontrollable urge to convert everything to the familiar, to reduce it all to the level of the primate brain, to reject the living, breathing reality of the totality of all possible attention.
The chapter basically unpacks that.
Right.
You know, as is often the case, as we saw in HBM, as we saw in Practical Work on Self, and really we saw in Joy of Sacrifice too, that there's a header to these chapters, and then the chapter unpacks it. I mean, writing that header was an art form in itself, I would say.
Well, then there's an envoy also.
Well,
say there's a little poem at the end.
We'll get to that. That little surprise. So,
yeah.
We're going to launch into it. Okay, now, the first three paragraphs are critical. So we're going to spend a teeny bit of time on them. From previous efforts and understanding, we have established a new relationship between the non-biological essential self and the human biological machine, and have already demonstrated to our satisfaction that the human machine does indeed provide us with the means of transformation. We clearly see the path which we must take. So what does it mean there, Ivan? From previous efforts and understanding.
Well, I think that's a direct reference to the trilogy, to the idea that this is the second in the Labyrinth Trilogy. In fact, it says, in this original edition, it says the Labyrinth Trilogy Book 2 on the back cover. So this book is meant to follow immediately the human biological machine, the transformation of the
Well, and I think that this is, the author is, I don't know if I call it, making an assumption here, the author is making the strong suggestion that I and David and you, that, you know, everybody as the reader, has not only read but thoroughly integrated the human biological issues.
It's actually essential that we do that. So we're going to cover a little bit of that material, but we're not in a beginning course here. I've said that all along when we went to the last one. Many of you have been through one or two passes through HBM, human biological machines, and several passes through practical work on self. And for me, I didn't see this until was the capstone, the connecting rod really is Joy of Sacrifice for me.
Well,
not written
great,
that way.
It was great reading Joy of Sacrifice.
It was really, really quite something. So we're basically, if you've done any reading in the spiritual literature, you're going to find out that this material that's being presented is unique. HBM is unique. Not that it isn't hinted at in a lot of the literature, but it's unique in its clarity. And what the fundamental, I mean, it's a 200-plus page book, but one of the critical and exciting concepts that's included in it is that we are an electrical body. In fact, we're two electrical bodies housed in the same thing here. And for most of the time, we go about and we're just simply a body, manifest as we are, here we are on this plane. So be it. But sometimes, not sometimes, in everybody's life, everybody, every human, there's these glimpses of a different life. And it's when their essential self opens up for a moment. So HBM is a long conversation about the interplay between the human biological machine, which we're not going to detail out, and the essential self. That's critical. Once you understand that, you have a way out. That's the thing that struck me, because we'll get into that later. But it's so exciting. It says, knowing that it is necessary to awaken the machine before we can do anything of objective consequence, we have hopefully achieved some stable results. And I ask you this, and I'd like you to actually write it into the log. Can you affirm that you have achieved some stable results? Can you write that in there as a question, Molly? Can you affirm that? And I would urge everyone, not for the sake of the log or for anybody else, but for your sake, to answer that question. Okay?
Are you saying it's a yes or no question, David, or do you want some details?
I don't need any details.
Oh,
I think
okay.
For the moment it's a yes or no question. For purposes of what we're doing now, a yes or no question
okay.
is sufficient.
Can we find out who we have attending? Take a moment to do that. Maybe Molly tells us, we'll find out who's on the phone here.
Is anybody else on the phone or just Lupe? Nope. Okay, no, you don't need to read that. We don't want to. Yeah, we're okay. We're not going to.
Can you have David repeat the question? I got part of it, but I didn't get the latter part.
Yes, Lupe. Here, I'm going to repeat it again for the recording as well. And I'm reading, literally, we've only got to the second paragraph, the entire chapter. I'm going to reread that paragraph. Knowing that it is necessary to awaken the machine before we can do anything of objective consequence, we have hopefully achieved some stable results. My question is, can you answer the question, have you achieved some stable results? That's the question. So, and hopefully, Lupe, I don't think I have your email address, but if you send it to me, then what I'll do is I'll send you the log as well. And we'll
okay.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Okay, that'll be great. I will send it to you, or I'll give it to you.
Yes, or just you can give it to Jenny or somebody, and they have my address.
Okay.
So that's where we have to start. We're not, once again, take on the fact you are not a beginning student. If you're a beginning student, this is not the right book. This isn't the beginning. This is not a beginner's book. You've walked down the path a bit, and you know how to walk a little bit, at least. So, we're going to go on. All right. By this time, we realize that we are now in need of further instruction to incorporate our present knowledge, and take us a step further toward our ultimate aim, the formation of what of which may not be very exact yet. And I put a caution on mine here. We are not looking for experiences only. We're not looking for phenomena. In this phase of the work, as we go through this book, phenomena will occur. So what? That's not the point. People will develop unusual things. They'll develop lucid dreaming. They'll see, they'll see auric bodies around somebody. They'll have distant intentionality. They'll, but that's just something that occurs. It's not, that's not what we're doing. Now in the next page, we're going to get to the definition. I'll try to hurry up a little bit faster. Okay, skipping ahead, I'm now on page 2. I'm just skipping ahead. We can now come to understand the essential self in its work role as the eternal voyager, exposed to perils and opportunities, purpose and distraction, fatal attraction and ultimate destruction in the nearly infinite immensity of the labyrinth. In this quest, we lift our gaze from its firm fixation upon the world of the primates. There it is. Working from this non-human perspective whenever we may discover ourselves to be, wherever. In the first book of the Labyrinth Voyager series, the human biological machine as a transformational apparatus, the analogy of a fish tank was invoked. The animal kingdom will once again be a surface. And then EJ goes into talking about the rat in the maze and how that, you know, used to be studied immensely, and you put a rat in a maze and it didn't know what to do, and then gradually something different happened, which actually will get to us in the next chapter.
Can I just make a comment here?
Please.
You know, David asked me, actually, for this discussion, you know, what I could say or what I knew about the origin of this book, you know, this volume, the second in the trilogy. And, you know, I don't think I remember as clearly as with the human biological machine, you know, how this sort of talks gel and came together into this book. However, it's very clear, you can tell from the very outset, the foreword actually, which we didn't read, besides the introduction of Linda Corvo's David Mitchell, there's an author's foreword which you must read. It's a definite warning, or both an invitation and a warning to enter into this book. But I mean, this passage here about the rat and the maze, it becomes very obvious that there's some tongue-in-cheek jokes in here. You know, EJ is joking about the intelligence of the rat versus the intelligence of the human primate, or whatever, you know, these things. In other words, there are statements that are, I don't know what you'd call them, semi-serious or ironic, or there's something that's a little more like stand-up comedy. And I think that, you know, again, I believe most of us who are online here tonight, you know, having been through these other discussion groups, I think that if you can remember, if you compare this, even this first chapter with the human biological, with the entirety of the human biological machine, you'll find that there isn't any humor. There isn't any irony, any really deliberate irony and stand-up comedy like this in the entirety of the human biological machine. And it's a sign that this is what you're going to get from EJ in this book. There's a lot of subtleties in the writing style. There's a lot of tongue-in-cheek passages. You know, there's a lot of double entendre and ironic passages. And this is, you know, David was asking me about the editing. The fact is that when transcripts of EJ's talks were put together, you know, strung together into this book, the final editing on this volume was done in quite a different way than the human biological machine. It was done by EJ at his desk.
Uh-huh.
He heavily edited these chapters from the transcripts of talks that were given. So what you find here, you find there's a tendency towards, I would say, towards the Gurdjieffian style, you know, literary style.
Mm-hmm.
Very long, drawn-out sentences, you know, very convoluted trains of ideas, and very often irony, humor, and sometimes like outright absurdity. There are puns, you know, there are jokes, there's absurdity. So I think it's very worthwhile just to keep in mind as we go through that we should look for some of that.
Style.
Yeah, to be aware that there's both sense and nonsense being used together to convey some of these ideas.
And there's a reason why.
There's tone. In other words, there's a tone
there's
to it.
That's important.
Yeah.
There's a tone that is set, and it's the tone that's going to be important to capture here, not the linear thinking. We're not in Kansas anymore. That's the whole point. So, okay.
It's all about the labyrinth, so this is really true, yeah. Oh, can you tell that you're not in Kansas anymore?
That's where we come to next. And so we go to, jump to, in this book, the top of page 3. When it comes to mazes, human primates are every bit as predictable as rats, but without the perceptual and emotional clarity. Keen attention and intelligence of their hairier cousins. A lot can be learned about mazes by experimenting with and testing rats. By altering a maze, for instance, but keeping the basic clues the same, we see that the rat will follow old clues rather than the new layout of the maze. So, do we even have a sense of when the maze has changed?
You suggest it's here in this passage, but
we
often
don't. And we often don't. And we go on here. Along these lines, we may begin to make serious inquiries in the realms of repetitive mazes, alternating mazes that change suddenly and in unexpected ways in mid-game through interactive variables, relative constants, and the absence of objective or absolute constants. Interesting, huh? Been jumping ahead. Well, enough philosophy already. The fact is both rats and human primates tend to experience essentially the same problems of stress, social pressure, and possess prior to cultural conditioning and psycho-emotional imprinting, which is to say, the usual deep brain impulse, responsive pain, and pleasure formatting. Precisely the same initial intuitive innocence, largely through the inattention, which can only come from the lack of self-motivation and the absence of environmental and biological stimuli, which is very similar to what we heard from Spinoza. After experience has taught me the usual surroundings of...
Yeah.
Yeah. also, and then in the next paragraph, if we are to produce a potent method for our excursions into the macro dimensions, so I'd like us to underline that and put that on a little card somewhere. And if you stay with us through these chapters, the question will be, did we achieve that? Did we create a potent method for navigating through the use of this, of these talks and chapters that we're studying? That's part of our goal then. We're going to evaluate this book. Does it provide that for us? Still, this doesn't actually ensure that anything will come of it. After all, even the most experienced rat is still subject to the maze, still a prisoner, a laboratory animal subject to outside whim. And in this sense, but only in this sense, the rat is not free. Not free. Okay, jumping ahead. Now, here's the definition. The labyrinth, a macro-dimensional maze camouflaged by the fabric of biological boundaries. So let's grab that one for a little while. So what does it mean? Let's just unpack it. Does anybody have a sense of what is meant by the macro-dimensional? What is meant by that? Macro-dimensional maze. Anybody? Raise your hand. We have a taker here in the vast audience. Inconceivable totality of creation. Aspects of which are unknowable in our particular form of consciousness. Anybody else? Yeah? The Bardo. Camouflaged by
the fabric of biological boundaries.
Okay. Camouflaged by that. What does it mean to be camouflaged? What is camouflaged? We have some very eager people in the audience here. Okay, you go ahead. So this person is asserting that the biological needs and so on blind you, and then you use the phrase, to what's around you? Yeah. I can see everything around me.
Biological mandate.
Exactly. I can see everything around me.
Yeah.
I'm the guy you're talking to. What's the big deal?
Well, you see, this statement here is suggesting that what you're perceiving is not necessarily the reality. It may be a reality. It's not necessarily the reality, or maybe not very much of the reality, but it's actually boundaries. Perceiving, I think he's saying, what you're perceiving is a set of boundaries.
What?
Or confinements. Well, it's like you're in the, you think you're in the wide world, but he's saying you're in your crypt.
I'm looking, I can see
you're seeing
this big room here,
yeah,
and there's a door. And
well, these are like the bars of your crypt, you see.
What am I missing?
Yeah, exactly.
Biological boundaries.
What is it, Molly?
Well, I'm stuck here.
Susan here.
Wait, go ahead. Who's this?
This is Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
Hey. She has an answer.
Well, I think they're talking about higher things that can't be seen.
What? I don't know what you mean, though.
Well, if they can't be seen, why would they be camouflaged?
two.
Well, let's say, you know, if they're, how about if they weren't camouflaged? Could they be seen then?
If your eyes could see.
Well, let's see if we get any hint in the text here. We're stuck.
Well, wait a second, David. Let me just say that he's, you know, did we cover that in what you read? This idea, you know, this isn't the first time they use that word, the macro dimensions, right, or macro dimensional. I think that it was introduced by the EJs, the author writing that using this formulation of the higher dimensions, you know, to see into the higher dimensions, which is we had in the human biological machine,
yep,
chapter or two, about the awakened state of the machine, and what is the function or the purpose or the aim of awakening the machine or being in the waking state. On, it was to observe, was to study the work, was to study what could be done in higher dimensions and so on, you know, even if you were a complete novice or, let's say, an outsider to the work. But I think you've got to realize that he's modulated this language from the earlier book. He's not going to talk about the higher dimensions now in this book, right?
Is there a copy of HDM? I believe it's chapter 20.
Yeah.
Where
what I'm saying is
where he actually defines transformation.
Oh, okay.
And the methodology of transformation is the, in a sense, the breaking of the lock that the human biological machine has on the essential self.
Mm-hmm.
And when the machine is awakened, at that point the essential self has a chance, in a sense, to exercise its muscles and become a little stronger and a little stronger. So this is what is meant by my question from the second paragraph is, have you achieved some stable results? Do you have a sense of how to awaken the machine? I know some of the people who are on the line, the answer is yes. The answer is yes. There doesn't have to be a qualification about it. Everybody
good.
That's here, the Molly is telling me, is yes. So accept that as a good starting point. Don't question yourself into nauseam and say, I'm not sure if I know to awaken it. I don't know if I'm awake. Or maybe I don't. Or maybe I'm not awake, but stop. That's what's holding you back. You do know how to do it. To start doing it, because that is the methodology of what transformation is. When you have begun to loosen that hold, you've begun to turn away the camouflage. Okay? Only when the essential self can stand on its own two feet, and that's what partly this book is, not only standing on its own two feet, that's what the HBM is about, now that it's on its own two feet, what do? Okay?
Yeah, this book is a continuation. It's going to be added together to the 83 somewhere.
And then, so to continue, if we know how to look, we can seize the opportunity to work our way through the passages, pitfalls and primrose paths of the macro-dimensional maze, but we don't know how to look. And in the beginning, we work to fathom the reality that we can be in the maze and yet be completely unaware of it. So what I wrote down for myself is that we may sense suddenly that our eyes have opened and we're sensing more around us. You can actually sense it right now. You pay attention to the space that's going on in this work we're doing together. You can sense it. But we have to learn the tools once there. One challenge that I did with some people who I was working with for a while is we'd have these meetings and everybody would go into this altered state like we are during this class. Can you hold that state when you walk through the door? Can you hold the state when you walk the door and then get in your car?
Yeah, touched on this during the even biological things, but you just reminded me of a, let's say, if this is our globalized version of a study circle. So
it is.
This is a third year or fifth year or something like that study circle. We're in postgraduate work here, folks. The study circle that I was in Tucson, I remember the most dramatic demonstration I remember our study circle leader produced of going up and down in states, you know, passing from that higher to the lower. We were having these intense, like an hour or two meetings, we were having intense discussions either at All and Everything, or we started reading texts of E.J. Gold and so on, and we had a very sort of refined atmosphere and a certain mood, you know, that comes along with study circle work after we had gotten into it, let's say, a few months' worth or something like that. And then so our study circle leader, he says to us, we broke up at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, whatever it was. He says, oh, let's go over to the all-night diner, you know, and let's go get a cup of coffee, and we can continue talking about this. And we all said, oh, sure, that sounds good. And we're all, so it was kind of like a social thing. So we go over to this all-night diner, and we proceeded to be, and then he made sure that everybody ordered, like, ice cream sundaes and coffee and, like, chocolate sauce and maraschino cherries, and we downed all this stuff, and then everybody got totally giddy, like, extremely, absurdly giddy, and we basically blew off all of this energy, everything that we had concentrated, and basically walked out of the room with in the study circle, because there was a point in the diner where our study circle leader looked at everybody and he shook his head and he said, well, Steve, what happened here?
Yeah.
And we all said, whoa, yeah, we blew off all of this concentration energy, and we were in a very biological, you know, we were very much involved with the boundary, you know, with
you're
the primate.
Very ordinary.
Well, we all had a big sugar rush. You know,
and what happened?
And ate all the sugar.
The machine will assert itself, and it is far more subtle, skilled, attentive than you. And we have the ability to know. It's really good. It's really good. But it has only one thing, and we're interested in something different. Voyagers, which is what we really are, seldom understand or are aware, and can easily fail to recognize the labyrinthine quality of what they're experiencing. And this is the camouflage emerge. Because they lack the power of serious, rooted, and undistractable attention behind the physical senses with which to view. Read that paragraph on top of 5 in this version, in the new version, page 5. Powerful.
From the top of 5 in this book, too.
Okay, good. We fail to recognize that we have passed this way many times before, and that we have made this or that turn. And more importantly, note well here, and more importantly, we fail to recognize the futility of everything we have done in the trivial pursuits of primate life. And this is exactly what Spinoza came to. After experience, it taught me that all the usual surroundings of social life are vain and futile. The difference is, as he said it, most of what we do is vain and futile. It's just carrying on the biological thing. And it has one purpose, reproduce, so that, guess what? Then they can reproduce. And then, oh gosh, then they can reproduce. That's pretty cool. But maybe there's a way out of it. Maybe we are sailing on a ship and we learn to tack against the wind in a different direction. We wouldn't be here if that's the case. And jumping ahead, in our preoccupation with trivial distractions of the biological machine, our superficial attention races quickly. Superficial, almost in an embarrassment. Past the majestic vistas of macro-dimensional events. I mean, you know, we all know the thing.
stop and smell the roses or the flowers. That's what it is. You stop and look for a moment. Stop. Actually pull over to the side of the road and look at the vista in front of you. We live in a beautiful area here, so it's easy to do, but we need to pay attention. And then something different happens. But we're stopping the chatter of the monkey mind that just continues. We are neither amused, astonished, nor amazed. This translation into the primate is a genuine sickness, as clinical as any commonly accepted mental condition truly is. We just don't feel like that. We accept it. But that's all HBM, Ivan. That's HBM. You just go back and read the book again. Right. And jumping ahead, now I'm on the bottom of page 6. And I don't think it goes on... But we act as if the primate world really exists, if we have a direct interface with it, as if there is an absolute certainty and tangible quality to it, when in fact none of it exists in the sense that we take it to exist even remotely. Now here's a wonderful sentence. We have walled ourselves into a veritable garden of familiarity, and now we are trapped in it with no hope of success. What a phrase. What a beautiful phrase that is. A garden of familiarity. And it's pleasant. We seek it. We come back to it. We want to be there again. We know it. And it's okay, quite frankly. If that's what you would like, that's okay. Embrace it. Go for it.
Okay. Yeah, it's a lot less stressful.
Because we don't know where we're headed.
To avoid these ideas.
We're looking in to walk into the jaws of chaos because we want to establish a roadmap for ourselves and our children or our predecessors. I heard one person say that if you free yourself, you free 3 generations that came before you. And 3 the generations that come after you. Think of the impact of your freedom that it has on your family members, whether you have children or not, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, vagrants, and everybody else who lives with you. Dogs, I guess. Hangers on. Cats, amputers, etc. Awesome? No, I'm not a female. But anyway, a veritable garden of familiarity. Veritable.
Veritable, not veritable.
Veritable, so you can verify it.
Yeah. Appropriate for this book.
Knowing our propensity for self-illusion, it isn't at all surprising to find that we have developed a mythology of banishment from the same garden in which we are forced to live out the remainder of our days.
It's reversing the Garden of Eden story.
It is. We can always emulate our fellow barely upright primates, shuffling aimlessly through the maze, oblivious to the subtlety. We know this. We walk through life. We see that that's what happens. But we're part of that too. But because we're here, there's just a little shelf that we can put our toes on and hang our fingernails on. We're not lost in it. There's one possibility. And that's what we're dealing with now. As I said, it's through practical work on self and joint sacrifice. And I'm saying again now, that the exercise, the opportunity that has been given to us. If we don't exercise the opportunity that's been given, it will be taken from us. I strongly suggest, we'll talk about it later on in one of the other chapters, that
read the parable of the talents in the Bible, in the New Testament. Powerful talent, powerful myth. Parable of the talents. You don't use it, taken from you. We learn the maze by rote, voyaging in typical human mechanical fashion. Of course, we're going to bring the tools that we have, and those tools just don't work. They don't work. But we have other tools, and we know we do. That's the choice. We voyage in typical human mechanical fashion, and even occasionally arrive accidentally by this method at the heart of the labyrinth. So it's possible to wind up in these certain places, but unless you have developed a certain resilience in moving in the labyrinthine manner, you're never assured. We are voyagers. Where does the voyager, how does the voyager go home?
Voyager, the journey is the destination.
There is no home. The voyager has no place to rest their head. That's frightening to the human biological machine, but it's freedom for the voyager. Freedom for the voyager. So all this first chapter is doing, and just I'm going to continue to read. This is the next paragraph on the bottom of page 7. Someone really soaked in the wine of primate life, who may have wandered 70 trillion and two times to the same macrodimensional sector, will fail to make the Palladian connection. The tendency is to lose contact with the macrodimensional state of consciousness. Ivan asked what Palladian meant.
I have to look that up. And Palladian.
Palladian refers to classical. It actually refers to classical architecture. So we fail to make the connection from point to point because we use the linear mind to do it. But that's all we think we have. And I'm saying, I'm positing the point. Maybe we have more than that. Did somebody ask about that?
Yeah.
Distant intentionality?
Yeah.
Where is that? Page 7?
No, it was just a comment I made.
Oh. It was? Oh, you did say something about that.
I said it. I didn't say anything about it.
I think David was referring to something like prescience, weren't you? Like an ability, referring to something like a psychic ability, which is to say that you're able to influence something distant.
I'm gonna create a side note here.
Yeah.
Distant intentionality, for me, is exactly a better term than prayer. It means the same thing for me, but prayer has a lot of baggage associated with it, so sometimes I use that phrase. And if you've done reading, if you've read for somebody, you might have a sense of what is meant by distant intentionality. When I say read for somebody, I mean read from the American Book of the Dead for someone who is in transit. I happen to be reading at the moment for three people. I don't know how that happened. But, and it's called being a labyrinth reader. So my focus is to deliver the teaching to those individuals. Do I have a direct linear association with them? No, they're dead.
Yeah, they're not exactly at the desk.
They're not right there sitting across the table from me. But nevertheless,
I carry this sense of distant intentionality. I am very interested. The distance is infinite.
Very far.
Because there is no distance in this world. The same with time. Same with time. It doesn't have the same meaning. So things will creep in like that for you. They'll creep in as you start down this path of more the living in a labyrinth. The book is called Life in the Labyrinth.
Right, Life in the Labyrinth. And this is, you know, it immediately pulls in the American book as a bit. You know, somebody mentioned the Bardos earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, much more so than the Human Biological Machine. This book enables the crossover between the Bardo teaching. You know, this is about life in the labyrinth with the macro dimensions and the Bardo teaching. You know, when you're reading, you read for someone and you say, now I am experiencing the clear light of objective reality. And, yeah, that's, you're delivering that to the voyager that you're reading for, right? But in a sense, but you're also joining, you're joining that voyager because you're not saying now you are experiencing the clear light of objective reality. You're saying now I am experiencing.
And it's a point
of
clarification. It's exactly right, Ivan. And thank you for that. It's a point of clarification for the voyager. Why? Well, we read it a few paragraphs ago because we don't know. We see something we don't know. What we have no eyes to see. So if we are launched into the labyrinth to an event that some people call death or transit, and you're suddenly there, and you don't have the markers that human life gives you, you're in a different world, right? So the reader, in the labyrinth reader in that point, is delivering information. That's all that's happening. You're delivering information to that voyager who doesn't have markers anymore, can't go, oh, there's the door. There is not even a door. So we're in a different place at that point. And so that's what I mean by distant intentionality, is that can I provide an intention of purity? By purity, I just simply mean that I am fundamentally neutral with regard to that information. But I am delivering it. Make sense? So where are we, Ivan?
That's the question for this book. It's always the question. Where are we?
Numberless primates have been and seen, yet to some strange vagary of the mind, blissfully forgotten, many more there are, who didn't see, whose occlusion indicates that they are just plain perceptually inept.
So also, yeah, this is going to be very common vocabulary in this
yes.
book. Occlusion, you know, where the let's see, I would say in the Human Biological Machine, there's a lot of scientific analogy is used, comparison, and you know, some of it's metaphor and some of it's actually reference to scientific research. It tends to be like biofeedback, you know, psychology. You know, the Human Biological Machine has a lot of psychological vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
psychology, and about the electrical fields of the body, neuroscience, about neuroscience and so on, which does come
in. Yeah.
But, you know,
well,
this is, in this book, there's like a very big emphasis. There's a big focus on perception, on this idea of occlusion. You know, that the vision, perception is occluded. In the primate, you're confined by these boundaries, biological boundaries. The primate tends, what is the statement up here? The tendency is to lose contact with the macrodimensional state of consciousness. So the tendency in ordinary life, in primate life, the sleeping state of the machine, the tendency is simply not to see what's there, something that is actually there.
Yes.
Something, or that he could be seen, or he's even mentioned, he's going to say quite a bit in some of these later chapters about the heart of the Bible. It's a very profound idea later on in this book. But he's saying here, people fall into, they happen into this part of the Bible. You know, they just,
right.
They should just coincidentally, you could turn up there. But for the most of life, most of primate life, for someone who does stumble into this or happens to touch upon it, they're not going to remember that. They're not going to know it happened. They're not going to be paying attention. They're not going to perceive that they're there. And so, what is that statement? There is no there there.
There was
in most of life, there's no there there. It's just whatever their ordinary cues of the maze, you know, whatever they're ordinarily surrounded by and what their ordinary significance is, that is what they're going to see and remember. They're not perceiving something with those levels or those other shades of meaning, subtlety.
But there are other cues in the labyrinth as we voyage and get more sensitive to it. I remember we were having a group dinner. It was one of the things where it was just packed. And this is when the kitchen was where the dining room is now, okay, some years ago. And we're just packed in that back room there. And it wasn't, I don't remember what was going on, but at one moment, I don't know how to say it, but it's almost, I don't want to mythologize it and say, but it was like something passed through the room. And I remember taking note of it. And I looked up, and I noticed that Barbara caught it and EJ caught it. And I knew that they knew that we had all caught it.
So that everybody in the room?
No.
All that everything?
Just those three individuals that moment.
Yeah.
That's like a different form of perception. The light didn't change. I attributed something like that more to like the sense of smell. It was like a whiff of something. But it was an internal sensing. Kind of a lot of what this book is going to be is to develop the sense of the sensing mechanism that we have and developing its subtlety. That becomes a working tool for us. And hopefully, what is indicated on page 2 there, to develop a potent method, will prove itself out. All this can lead any outside observer to conclude that a bizarre form of culturally induced schizophrenic alienation occurs between maze consciousness and conscious human reality.
Consensus
human reality, thank you. Agreed upon by convention, which in relation to macro dimension, macro consciousness can hardly be considered to represent consciousness. So he's implying here a form of consciousness beyond that which we're used to. That's where we're headed. It's almost, I remember once hanging out with Samuel Abitbol, which is a handful, and he described this as, he says, suppose somebody is giving a talk and verbally delivering a talk, and half the audience is literally physically blind. So they're just hearing the talk, right? And they're listening to it. I don't know if they take notes, but they're just concentrating on it. At the same time, through sign language, he's telling a different story altogether. That's what we're talking about.
Those who are blind are not getting the whole message.
Can we open our eyes in a brand new way and allow them to stay open. I think that's going to be part of our challenge here. So what's closing this chapter, Ivan?
I was going to say we could mention that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed king.
Thank God we're not going to mention that, though.
But we're not going to mention that.
No, my gosh.
That's why we created something at the Institute called the One-Eyed Journal at one time. That's an obvious reference. Well, I think David is referring to the little poem which ends this chapter. Each one of these chapters has
a quatrain.
Yeah. But this one here goes, it reads, human primates evidently think they are all alone in their sector, and they should be. I don't think that requires interpretation.
Not a lot.
Anyway, yeah, these are good. I love these little pieces at the end that make a book in themselves, just as a poem.
So,
so David, let me just say, I don't know if you were going to say this.
I was.
If you were going to say this, I'll let you say it.
Yeah, okay. No, go ahead.
We're kicking off a new book here. I really liked what we were doing towards the end of the Joyous Sacrifice discussions, where if we have an overflow, if people have comments, or let's say if you ask people for some documentation of something, you know, or to reply or respond, we had them type into your blog, into your type comments in for each chapter. Under the heading you had set up at thewingsofchaos.com. And I think we should try to do that for every chapter here. Let people type additional comments that we didn't get in here, your responses, your ideas about this chapter.
Now, for everybody that can see on computer, which Lupe, hopefully you're not also watching a computer while you're driving, but it's what happens is we start the class and we have a bit of an invocation. As the class continues, this is the only way to depict it. The invocation, in a sense, increases. At that point, there's a different form of knowledge available to you. That's when you grab that knowledge and post it on the site. The site is wingsofchaos.com, and then there's a whole thing for HBM. There's another one for Joyous Sacrifice, and now there's the beginning of one for Life in the Labyrinth. Harry has made a post on Life in the Labyrinth on Chapter 1.
Good.
In the next few days, I'll post the audio of this class, and then over the weekend, probably I'll get to posting the log itself. And then I also want to say that if you want to be included in the Institute isn't sending general emails out anymore as much, but I'm just sending one to people to give me their email addresses, and I send it out as blind CC so not everybody sees your address, but just you can let me know if you want to be included, or if you don't want to be included, that's okay too.
And also let's mention that the Institute is sending out a newsletter to an email list at least once a month. It's a new format, something that we put together here. It's quite the first one I thought was very useful. It had a lot of web links. What it had was a lot of URL links in the email to different projects and statements and postings and blogs and all kinds of things. So you could easily have spent a few weeks just checking out all the connections in this newsletter. So if you are not getting that, if you're not on that email list, you should write to whom? I don't know. You should call just here.
Info at.
Yeah, or write to info@idhsb.com.
Yeah.
There's a sign. Where is it? On which website? Yeah, you should go to idhsb.com on the web and sign up with your chosen email that you want to use for that, you know, to receive that newsletter, because that's the new distribution of news, basically, from IDHHB.
So go on the Wings of Chaos, post some comments, and we'll build on that as we go along. So any other questions, Molly, that are...
Any other feedback over there?
Pending?
Is Robert there? Sinhog. Hey, if anybody can send the log to me, I would appreciate it. So, the entire log, I don't know who's on, but...
On Justin TV.
The Justin TV log, because I post that, and people like sometimes like to read that.
Was it Simon who was sending it to you the last cycle, or was it Silverdale?
Yeah, in South America.
Oh, okay.
And Robert, or Sinhog, used to send it, but... oh, good, then she'll
okay.
send it. She's very right. good at that, too. Well, thank you for coming. I'm back into the bathwater and enjoying it immensely. So,
all right.
We'll see you again next Wednesday, 7 o'clock.
For further voyages in the labyrinth.
Chapter 2, read ahead. Take care. Good night.
Good night, all.